This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Songwriter Ellie Greenwich died Wednesday in New York at the age of 68. Greenwich co-wrote many of the girl group hits of the 1960s, including these. All the songs we've just heard were co-written by Ellie Greenwich and Jeff Berry, who were briefly married. With the exception of Chapel of Love, which Greenwich and Berry co-produced, all the records we heard were produced by Phil Spector, the first real genius of pop production. Ellie Greenwich didn't write exclusively for the girl groups. Her songs include Leader of the Pack, recorded by the Shangri-Las, I Wanna Love Him So Bad by the Jelly Beans, River Deep, Mountain High, done by Ike and Tina Turner, Maybe I Know by Leslie Gore, I Can Hear Music, recorded by the Beach Boys, and Doo-Wah Diddy, performed by Manfred Mann. Greenwich was one of the few women to break into pop songwriting in the early 60s. She grew up in Levittown on Long Island, and she got her start when she was hired as a staff writer by the songwriting team of Lieber and Stoller. She worked out of the Brill Building in Manhattan, the headquarters of many of the top 40 songwriters and producers in the 60s. When the British Invasion took over the charts and groups started performing their own original material, a lot of songwriters ended up out of work. Greenwich went on to write jingles and also co-produced many of Neil Diamond's early hits. Terry interviewed Ellie Greenwich in 1986, at a time her career was enjoying a brief resurgence, with a Broadway review of her songs which introduced her to listeners who never stopped loving her songs but never knew who wrote them. Terry asked about the song Chapel of Love, one of the first hits that Greenwich co-wrote and co-produced.
That song had originally been cut by the Ronettes. Phil Spector had cut it with the Ronettes, but never put it out. Why? Do not ask me. And we always believed in that song. We knew it had to be a spring release or a summer release because of the nature of, you know, Chapel getting married, June weddings, the whole thing. And what happened was when they did not put that, when Phil Spector didn't put that record out, Jeff and I said, we have to do something with it. And just at that time, a gentleman named Joe Jones came up from New Orleans with a whole slew of people. Amongst them was three girls, which we eventually named the Dixie Cups. And here were all these singers just hanging out at the office, you know, Lieberman Stowe's office. And we said, girls, come here a minute. And we went to the piano, and we played it for them, and they sang. So it's very, I mean, anybody could sing Chapel of Love, you know? And we said, we have to go in and make this record. And it's funny, in my whole career of being in the studio producing, there were only two songs that I literally walked out of a studio and said, either these records are going to be zippity-doo, nothing, go nowhere, or number one records. That was Chapel of Love and Leader of the Pack.
Did you have a special rapport with the singers and the girl groups being a woman yourself?
I think initially, it's funny, back then, because I was so involved in the productions and working with the working on the background vocals and what have you, I was not just, well, here's my song, see ya. I got involved in everything. And it wasn't that accepted back then, a female being in that end of the business. A songwriter, a lyricist, automatic acceptance. A background singer, automatic acceptance. A writer, because Carole King and I were really the only female writers then that I know of that actually sat at the piano and sang the song and really got involved. And that wasn't, because it was, there were so few of us that, you know, it was sort of like looked on and you know, walked away from a little bit. But what happened was eventually the girl said, gee, we have someone we can really relate to, somebody we can talk to. We have headaches today. We want to tell somebody who's going to understand better than Ellie. So at first it was like, well, who does she think she is giving us orders here or telling us what to do? But on the other end, if you just were very open with them, they saw they could be your friend. And then it became an asset to be a woman dealing with the girl groups.
How much did you, when you were starting, and did the groups that you wrote for really know about love and sex?
We really knew very little. We really were, as we said, that, you know, the good girls. And we just knew what we read, and we knew what we fantasized about. And our experiences really were very limited. But you could, if you don't write about what you've experienced, you certainly can write about fantasy, so it comes out the same way.
What were some of the problems that you had breaking in and getting accepted, being a woman? Because as you just pointed out, there really weren't many women songwriters in the early 60s.
Well, I think I was very fortunate in that most of the early things I got involved in became hits. So what choice did so many of these people have when I said, well, hey, you know, I have a little track record here. This was a hit, and this is doing well on the charts, and I'm doing, you know, and it was almost like, well, we don't love, you know, like the musicians would say, we don't love a woman telling us to go like this on your guitar, but I said, look at me as the thing. Forget, you know, and I think because of my success, it made it a little easier. Plus, I did a lot of co-producing with Jeff, so I had the little male protector on one side, you know, so I think the combination of the success and having Jeff there, they really didn't have much of a choice, did they?
What was your technique for writing songs together?
Very often we would get ideas separately and then come to one another with our ideas. We would generally have title first and write what we call our hook line or our chorus. Sometimes I played piano. Sometimes Jeff would play piano. Once again, both of us doing both, sometimes we would actually both sit down at the piano and like almost kill each other because I'm playing one thing, he's playing another. But we did complement each other, and we found a way for some reason that the songs just happened with us. It was the most natural, with whomever I've written with since, Jeff and I still had the most natural writing partnership that I've ever experienced.
You got married to each other, and, you know, after all, you'd written songs like Chapel of Love, you were writing all these, Today I Met the Boy I'm Going to Marry, all these great love and wedding songs, Not Too Young to Get Married. Did you think that you were going to have a marriage that was everything that the song said marriage was going to be?
Well, I have to, flee in on something. I grew up in Levittown, Long Island, on the corner of Starlight and Springtime Lane. You tell me if I thought my marriage was... Yes, I did. I really believed in the little house with the white picket fence and together forevermore, and absolutely believed that I was really a dreamer. And I think that still can happen. Unfortunately, it didn't happen for us, and I think that was partly the business fault. But yes, I was very much a hopeful romantic.
Songwriter Ellie Greenwich speaking with Terry Gross. Here's another hit she co-wrote. That's the Ronettes. More with Ellie Greenwich after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview recorded in 1986 with songwriter Ellie Greenwich, who died on Wednesday.
One of the big hit songs that you wrote was Leader of the Pack, which you co-wrote. And it was performed by the Shangri-Las, who I always think of as being the tramps of the girl groups, because they had such a tough
You think
image.
They were trampier than the Ronettes? I mean, Terry, please.
How did you get to work with those Shangri-Las?
Well, there was a guy that I knew named George Morton, whom we, because he was also one that was a little eccentric and like would never show up on time, so we ended up calling him Shadow Morton. So George calls me. He has this tape and a bunch of girls he wants me to hear. Brought the tape to the office, and this thing went on. He did his male narration. It was 7 minutes long. I said, no, we can't do that. But there was something very interesting in this song. Different. I said, who is this singing? This thing black there? You know, I said, wow, it's a very different sound. Saw a picture of them and said, see, that there's where, what an added thing. What an interesting-looking little group here. And met with them, and the record came out. Big hit. It's now time for a follow-up. So Shadow said, we got to write something together. And at that time, when you made money, you bought yourself boots or motorcycles. I mean, that was really what it was all about. So everybody, every male, Jeb, Shadow, the engineer, the arranger, they all had motorcycles, and they were always riding motorcycles. I said, why don't we do something with motorcycles? Okay, we can call it. There's always a leader. So the head of the group. I said, no, it doesn't sound good. And we just threw titles around. Leader of the Pack sounded important. And Shadow Morton also had a habit of writing little soap operas. His songs all became these little mini soap operas, right? So with his influence, we will, you know, we melodically did certain things, whatever. And he had this, had to be a six song. Let's get, and Jeff had written Tell Laura I Love Her. So he was used to being about with the sick element. This was new for me. I said, hey, as long as it's not too disgusting and I can deal with it. So I think we had everything from the sound effects to motorcycles to boy loving, you know, the girl loving the boy that's forbidden. I mean, all these, death, my God. I mean, it was like everything was in there. And once again, like I said, and there was the way Mary sounded, the way the whole group looked, I thought the picture was a perfect picture and the record was just the perfect kind of a thing to be a top record.
Why don't we hear it? Okay.
Okay.
This is Leader of the Pack, co-written by my guest Ellie Greenwich and performed by the Shangri-Las.
Is she really going out with him?
Well, there she is. Let's ask her.
Betty, is that Jimmy's ring you're wearing?
Mm-hmm.
Gee, it must be great riding with him. Is he picking you up after school today?
Mm-mm.
By the way, where'd you meet him?
I met him at the candy store. He turned
Yes, we see.
That's when I fell for
the sort of smile and kiss me goodbye. The tears were beginning to show. As he drove away on that rainy night, I begged him to go slow. And whether he heard, I'll never know.
So helpless, what could I do? Remembering all the things we've been through. In school they all stop and stare. I can't hide the tears, but I don't care. I'll never forget him, the leader of the pack.
That really still sounds great.
It's fun, isn't it?
It really is. How did you decide to get in the screeching wheels and the motorcycle revving up, all the sound effects? Why did you decide
to
put it in?
We had to. Uh-huh. I mean, how could you have a song about a motorcycle without a motorcycle sound in it? I mean, that was half the record. The gimmick. That was the gimmick part of the record.
Rock music was the music of rebellion, and it really separated children from their parents. Because parents were listening to Steve and Edie Gourmet, and the kids were listening to your records. But you were from the suburbs. You were from Levittown.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel like you had to act a little tougher than you really were in
no.
order to fit in, or anything like that?
No, I was not. I was not a rebel, and I'll never be. No, any good. No. I didn't feel I had to prove anything or be that different or whatever. I just, first of all, once again, most of the songs that I had the hits with were very romantic, nice songs. I mean, you know, my most off-color song was Hanky Panky, you know, and when people say, and yet my baby does the Hanky Panky, she dances, she this, she kisses me, whatever you want it to mean. I left the door wide open. I never said it, you know?
Did your parents like your songs?
Funny. My parents, may they rest in peace, were very supportive of what I wanted to do, didn't quite understand what it was. When my mom used to tell her friends, like, well, you know, my daughter's a songwriter, they would say, well, gee, we're really sorry. So she changed the term to, well, my daughter's in musical productions. Well, that's just wonderful. Then it made more sense to them, you know? And what happened was, because I started having success so early, they were very, of course, fearful, like, what was she going to get into in this? They've heard such stories about the music business, the industry so crazy. But, I mean, I am level-headed, you know, and they did see that. And they were very happy for my success because I was very happy with it. I mean, I was doing my first love. I was earning a living at it, you know. I was married. I mean, I had the whole, all bases covered at that time in my career, so they were very happy for me, really, very proud.
Songwriter Ellie Greenwich speaking with Terry Gross in 1986. Greenwich died Wednesday in New York. She was 68. We'll close with Ellie Greenwich singing one of her hit songs. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fritz Air.
Today I met the boy I'm gonna marry. He's all I wanted all my life and even more. He smiled at me and gee, the music started playing. Here comes the bride when he walked through the door. Today I met the boy I'm gonna marry. Dreams and love I wanna share. Far on my hand, a band of gold appeared before me. The band of gold I always dreamed I'd wear.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Our next guest is actor Danny McBride. Last summer, he was in two hit films. In the comedy Pineapple Express, a hybrid stoner and action film, he played a drug dealer who was beaten and shot and shot and shot again, but like a lot of characters in far-fetched action films, just kept on going. In Tropic Thunder, a comedy about actors making a jungle war movie, he played the pyrotechnics expert on the set. Now he's starring in the HBO comedy series Eastbound and Down. The DVD of its first season is now available. McBride plays Kenny Powers, a relief pitcher famous for his fastball and his big mouth. When he loses his fastball and becomes even more obnoxious, he finds himself exiled from the big leagues, so he reluctantly takes a job as the substitute gym teacher in his old middle school. In this scene, he has his kids dressed up as gladiators with fencing swords when the principal walks in.
From this moment on, you guys are no longer little kids. You're cold, calculated murderers. This is a mindset you got to be in if you want to be a champion. You got me? Cuddy, what do you need, bro?
Oh, no, I'm just observing the class. Carry on, please, because I am awfully intrigued.
Class, do we want the principal of the school in our secret meeting of learning?
Well, it's really not up to any of you guys. It's just part of my job. I have to observe my teachers. So.
People have spoken, Cut. Hit the halls, baby.
Okay. Let's just try and clean up some of our language. And I'll just stand over here. That's fine with me. Yeah.
That'd be great for me.
I'll tell you, most of the teachers on the staff don't have a problem with me observing, but...
Well, I think you're about to find out that I ain't like most of these goddamn teachers.
Okay. How's that? Am I out of your peripheral?
Anyway, so... Besides getting shot in the back of the head, do you know what else Abraham Lincoln did? He was a champion wrestler in high school. And I'm not making that up.
Danny McBride, welcome to Fresh Air. So you were a substitute teacher before you started working as an actor and screenwriter. Did you take any experiences from your days as a substitute teacher and put them into Eastbound and Down?
You know, that was one of, the first ideas of where Eastbound came from was I remember I was subbing and I'd been living in L.A. for a few years and really hadn't gotten anywhere. And I went back to substitute teach and I think I was subbing like for a German class or something. I don't speak German or anything. And I can remember introducing myself to the class on the first day saying, you know, I'm Mr. McBride. And I started to find myself like justifying why I was there to these high school kids who couldn't care less. I was just telling them like, you know, this is just a stop on the way for me. I don't really plan on doing this forever. And I think it was that sort of arrogance, you know, which has kind of inspired Kenny Powers of like, you know, I didn't really mind subbing. I thought it was actually pretty cool. And it gave me some good ideas for writing, but I was just, you know, thinking the whole time, God, if I didn't like doing this, this would be a horrible thing to have to come home and do after you've fallen from grace.
The funny thing is, too, it's such an insult to the students to say, I don't really want to be here. This isn't
exactly
what I should be doing. I should be doing something much better than this.
than shaping your mind.
Than shaping your mind. Yeah, this is just like an unwanted stop along the way being here with you. Because you get no respect at all as a substitute teacher.
None. All they care about is what kind of car you drive, and yeah, they don't care.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Danny McBride, and he's now starring in a series that he also co-writes on HBO called Eastbound and Down. Let's talk a little bit about Tropic Thunder. And Tropic Thunder is about actors making a jungle war movie on location, inspired by Rambo and all the other movies like it. And you play the special effects and pyrotechnics expert on the set. So you're the guy who does, like, you know, the dynamite blasts and the fire and the napalm. And I want to play a scene from the film. You're in the jungle talking with the grizzled war hero who's the military consultant for the film. He's played by Nick Nolte. And the movie that you're making is based on his memoir, Tropic Thunder. Here's the clip.
So we gotta light these boys up today, huh? Blow some sense into these young men. Hey, I don't want to come off as weird or anything, but I might be your biggest fan.
Yeah.
Tropic Thunder. Kind of like my Catcher in the Rye.
Yeah, I've never been in the military per se, but I have lost an appendage in the line of duty. Driving Miss Daisy for a studio gig.
Yeah. It's a pretty cool sidearm you got there.
What is it?
I don't know what it's called. I just know the sound it makes when it takes a man's life.
Okay.
Damien, we're go for explosion, ready to kick the tires and light the fires on your say-so. Damien, we're go for explosion.
I love the idea that you, the special effects man, lost a finger in Driving Miss Daisy,
which was a special effects heavy film. Of course,
that's such a slow moving film about a driver and the woman that he drives. So, what did you learn about pyrotechnics? Playing the pyrotechnics expert.
I learned a lot. I got to shadow the special effects guys, and I learned how to use a flamethrower, which was probably the highlight of my education there. And it was crazy. It was like going to movie star camp. You know, you're there on location in Hawaii, and there's guys from like Nolte to Jack Black to Robert Downey Jr. Everyone has such a different process, and you're sitting there just kind of taking it all in. It was really amazing.
Well, speaking of process, Robert Downey Jr. in Tropic Thunder plays an actor, a white actor who's playing an African American soldier, and because the character Downey plays is such like the method actor, he starts to convince himself that he is black, and he never gets out of character, so he acts black even when he's not on the set. And since Downey is such an eccentric actor to begin with, what was it like to work with him playing this parody of like the worst cliche of the method actor?
It was pretty amazing. I mean, we would be around Downey all day on the set, and I would just forget it was Downey. You know, at nighttime, you'd see him for dinner and be like, oh, yeah, I keep forgetting that Robert Downey Jr. is in this movie. That's him in the daytime. But, one of the things I remember early on, it was like the second day of filming, I think, and in between takes, the sound guys, they'll usually cut off everybody's mics. But for some reason, I think they had, by accident, left Downey's mic on, and I had an earwig in. I could hear what he was saying. He was still mic'd in between the take. And I can remember just like watching him, and I could, I watched him kind of leave the set, and he's like walking back to the trailers, and I'm like, oh, it's crazy, they're leaving his mic on. I can hear him talking to himself, and he was just still in character, going back to his trailer, talking about how he was going to go drain the lizard, and he was just still speaking in his voice from there. It's like he's not dropping it at all. It was pretty impressive.
That's really funny because he's like doing what his character does, which is like staying
exactly.
in character.
He doesn't drop character to the DVD commentary, he says.
That's really so funny. But he's so terrific in it. So were you ever afraid being around any of the fires and explosions in the movie?
The only one that was a little tricky was that first real big explosion in Tropic. They had the rest of the crew like a mile away from the explosion, and I was the closest one to the explosion. They had me up in the tower with the camera guy and an AD, and they were like, that you should be okay here, even though we've moved the rest of the crew a mile away from this explosion. And they literally had a fire blanket up there. They're like, if you feel like, it really immense heat, just duck and put this blanket over yourself. And so I'm expecting like a fireball to come shooting into that tower, and then of course when it goes off, it wasn't anything too scary. I wish I had been a little closer, actually.
The last year or so has been really big for you. You were in Tropic Thunder and Pineapple Express over the summer, and Foot Fist Way opened when, like, a year or so ago.
Yep.
And so you've gone, and now you've got your TV series on HBO. So you've gone from pretty big obscurity to some degree of relatively sudden fame. So how is that affecting your life, and how is that affecting your thoughts on what it's like to be kind of famous?
I guess, I guess the main difference is I'm just not worrying about how I'm going to pay for my car insurance or health insurance anymore. I mean, I've still surrounded myself with all the guys that, I went to school with, and we all hang out together. And so, my personal life hasn't really changed that much since before all this began. I think I can just rest easier that I'm not bouncing checks right and left anymore.
Were you bouncing checks?
I was always living in overdraft when I was in L.A. It was hard not to. I mean, I was just PA-ing or waiting tables, doing whatever I could do to kind of make ends meet.
Right. So you mentioned now you can buy health insurance. So do you have like a group plan? I mean, it's not like you have an employer per se.
You can get very good health insurance through SAG and the Writers Guild. So that's what I signed up for.
Mm-hmm. Good. Okay.
All right. You sound like my mom. She's very proud that I have health insurance. That's probably the thing she's the most proud about with everything. It's like, good, you have health insurance. If something happens to you, we're not going to lose our home.
Well, Danny McBride, thanks so much for talking with us.
Cool. Thank you.
Danny McBride stars in the HBO comedy series Eastbound and Down. Its first season is out on DVD. Tenor saxophonist Lester Young was born 100 years ago yesterday, on August 27, 1909. He came to prominence in the 1930s as a member of Count Basie's band and as a sideman with Billie Holiday. Later, he went out on his own and took part in stage jam sessions on Jazz at the Philharmonic tours. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says as a saxophonist, Lester Young was an original who inspired some of jazz's hottest and coolest players.
Lester Young playing the blues in 1944, sometimes writing one repeated note, a move copied by Illinois Jacquet and umpteen rhythm and blues saxophonists. In the 1930s, Young set the tone for jazz musicians who seem a little too cool for the world. He was a contrarian, even held his saxophone at an odd angle. David Stone Martin once drew him playing before the Tower of Pisa, leaning the other way. And he had a gift for memorable metaphorical slang. Lester on caring for his baby daughter. I don't mind the waterfall, but I can't stand the mustard. He nicknamed everybody and everything, but friend and colleague Billie Holiday gave him his nickname, Prez, short for President of the Tenor Saxophone.
A sailboat in the moonlight and you. Wouldn't that be heaven? A heaven just for two. A soft breeze on a June night and you. What a perfect setting for letting dreams come true. A chance to...
When Lester Young was coming up, he often got compared to reigning tenor sax champ Coleman Hawkins. Prez didn't set out to contradict Hawk, he just followed his own lights, but the contrast was striking. Hawkins was all poise and elegance, weaving rhapsodic melodies out of notes found in or implied by a tune's ever-changing chords. Prez's tone was lighter, and his lines floated over the chords, as if he got to the changes a little early or late. It gave his solos an aloof, detached quality. But he also had an airborne sense of swing beyond Hawkins. Basie's Lester Leaps In, 1939. 3 years earlier, after kicking around the Midwest and Southwest for years, Lester Young had come east with Basie's blues-drenched Kansas City band. En route, in Chicago, they'd cut a classic small group date, including blues shouter Jimmy Rushing.
I may be wrong, but I won't be wrong always. And I may be wrong, but I won't be wrong always. Gonna long for me, baby, one of these all rainy days.
That's the blues as music of defiance. May be blue, but won't be blue always. But Lester Young also knew the woeful blues, He was drafted in World War II, and predictably, an odd-talking, contrary African-American pothead with a white wife didn't really fit the 40s Army. He was court-martialed and locked up for 10 months. Legend says he was a broken man ever after, but friends denied it, and he didn't always sound it. Ding Dong, 1949, with bebop drummer Roy Haynes. After the war, bebop was jazz's new wave, and boppers dug how Young leaned behind the beat to sound relaxed and yet build suspense. Charlie Parker's alto could sound like early Prez speeded up. But after the war, Young's ballads could get more heavy, less aloof and detached. Even his blithe old way of harping on one note could sound forlorn. In the 1950s, Lester Young made some nice records, but went into slow decline, mired in depression and drink. He was bitter about the greater success of some cool white saxophonist he inspired. He once quipped, "Stan gets the money." Young's solo on Billie Holiday's Fine and Mellow from the 1957 TV show The Sound of Jazz finds him all but fading away on camera. It's worth seeing on YouTube, also for the way Billie looks at him. Lester Young insisted jazz musicians needed to find their own styles. And in fairness to admirers Illinois Jacquette, Charlie Parker, and Stan Getz, none of them sounded quite like him. So they got the message. As Prez himself once put it, originality is the thing. You can have tone and technique and a lot of other things, but without originality, you ain't really nowhere.
Kevin Whitehead teaches at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. Yet another event to mark the 40th anniversary of the Woodstock Music Festival is director Ang Lee's new film, Taking Woodstock. Set in White Lake and Bethel, New York, it's based on a 2006 memoir by Elliot Tiber, who had a front row seat, not at the concert itself, but at negotiations that led up to it. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Ang Ang Lee's last film was called Lust, Caution, which is an apt description of the play in all his work between yielding to messy feeling and exercising discipline, holding back. He's among the last directors I'd think of for a movie about the 1969 Woodstock Festival, which was, at least in the popular imagination, all yielding and no holding back. But it's easy to see why Elliot Tiber's temperate memoir, Taking Woodstock, caught his fancy. Tiber, born Teichberg, was a closeted young gay man, an heir to a seedy, debt-ridden Catskills motel. When the proposed festival was expelled from several small New York towns, whose elders feared a glut of filthy, nasty hippies, Tiber saw an opportunity and contacted its planners. He found them a spot at Max Yazger's nearby farm. His parents' motel became a planning hub. And, well, by the time Joni Mitchell got to Woodstock, they were all stardust and golden. Lee and his producer and screenwriter, James Shamus, have made a film that's gentle and rather tepid. It's pleasant, but over its 2+ hours, it doesn't build up much counterculture fervor. Lee always seems like a visitor to whatever milieu he's depicting, ancient China, the Old West, the hippy-dippy 60s, and he brings a cool, cerebral eye to a setting that cries out for the hustle of a Robert Altman movie. Most of the emotional weight in Taking Woodstock is on transactions, like this one for motel rooms, between Dimitri Martin as Tiber and Jonathan Groff as organizer Michael Lang, in a vest with no shirt, looking like a scrubbed hippie Adonis from a stock company production of Godspell.
You know, we're going to need a place for people to crash while we prepare the festival. Your place looks pretty cool. How many vacant rooms do you have for the next couple of weeks?
Well, it depends on how you define room.
You know, how many people can crash with you? What do you guys charge?
Let's see. It's $8 a night, but that can be for doubles. And we give a weekly discount, of course. Plus the cabins, you can get cots, so 4 people per, about 150, I'd say. You can get about 200 people.
Hey, man, let's make it easy. Why don't we just buy the Elmonico out for the season? Just figure out the costs, write it down, we'll take a look. And if we don't use all the rooms, you can rent out the free ones. We need to keep some cleanup crews around afterwards. If you got some bigger spaces for offices, that kind of thing, we need to put in some phones and have some space to park vehicles. You know where we're going? Mm-hmm.
Part, but by no means all, the problem with Taking Woodstock is Dimitri Martin. On his Comedy Central show, he's a deadpan genius, dropping one-liners that seem to come from the dark side of the moon, yet illuminate everything. But the part of Elliot Tiber taps nothing except his bland ingenuousness, and he ends up a dull bystander. In his memoir, Tiber doesn't have a sparkling personality either, but early chapters detail the pain of being in the closet and reveal he was at the Stonewall Bar in Greenwich Village the night of the police raid. Imagine throwing rocks at police at Stonewall and then grooving at Woodstock. You'll have to imagine. There's no hint of that side of Tiber on screen. The other characters leave you just as indifferent. Even Emil Hirsch as a traumatized Vietnam vet, and Liev Schreiber as a giant transvestite named Vilma who becomes the motel's director of security. Schreiber goes against the grain and plays Vilma straight and matter-of-fact. But the movie needs more loopiness, more risk-taking. Well, there is one vivid performance, the British actress Imelda Staunton, fresh from her turn as Harry Potter's most sadistic instructor, as Tiber's monstrous, penny-pinching, Jewish hysteric of a matriarch. Watching Staunton's high-pitched, Yiddish-accented rants, you don't know where to look. She's amazing and awful. Her stylized performance is in a different key than anyone else's. The experience of Woodstock inspired Tiber to leave his parents and embrace his sexuality. But on screen, it's studied, as if the director were an android reproducing transcendence without experiencing it. There is one evocative moment when Tiber hears the first stirrings of the concert through the trees, thrilling yet ghostly. But the show itself is never glimpsed. Sure, Tiber was busy at the motel, and the filmmakers couldn't afford 500,000 extras. But seeing nothing is a bummer, man. The sheer scale of Woodstock is central to its place in history. The movie ends with motel leave-takings and an allusion to the groovy next fest, at Altamont. What a cynical way to cap things off. Taking Woodstock is a celebration that feels like a dirge.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Fred Snyder, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.